Well, as I see it, this can go one of two ways. Either the proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution to define marriage as a man and a woman only, and to permit to the state legislatures the ability to form civil unions in lieu of gay marriage, either that will pass, and sooner or later we'll be calling those civil unions marriages. Maybe we'll just put quotations around them. Or the constitutional amendment will fail. The states will continue to deal with this in an ad hoc way, and we'll end up pretty much in the same boat. One way or the other, whether you put the quotes around the word marriage or not, I think we're headed that direction. Now, what does that mean for the future of our society if we're talking about marriage in quotes or marriage not in quotes becoming, for homosexuals, a legal reality? What will it mean for our society? Gay marriage is the subject for the second hour of Issues, Etc., the first 25 minutes. Dr. Christopher Wolfe is our guest. He joins us. He is professor of political science at Marquette University in Milwaukee, and he's editor of the book. We've talked to him before about this. The book is called Homosexuality in American Public Life. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Wolfe, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you.
Are we headed toward gay marriage, whether we put it in quotations or not, one way or the other as a political reality?
Well, we don't know for sure yet, which is good news, that there's still a chance to stop it. But, you know, I think the odds are, you know, if you were a betting man, you'd probably bet in favor of it. The problem is this. First of all, you have judges in the country who are very committed to what you might call a sexual autonomy principle. And they have expanded this over the years, and they're now in some ways simply, you know, applying the logic of it to homosexuality and to gay marriage. And we've seen the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court impose gay marriage on Massachusetts. Earlier, Vermont had imposed at least a kind of civil union status, which is said in the law itself to be equivalent to marriage, on Vermont. And it's only a question of time, really, before other judges in other jurisdictions, and eventually, probably, the Supreme Court do the same thing nationally. You know, I don't know whether the U.S. Supreme Court is likely to do it very soon. They might want to let things percolate a little bit more before they step into that particular hornet's nest. But it's likely to happen down the road, given the previous decisions they have. So given that fact, you know, you're really looking at the likelihood that eventually gay marriage will be imposed. In addition, we're operating with a really important demographic factor here, and that's the fact that young people are much more in favor of gay marriage than older people. And, of course, this reflects the fact that they have been raised in an era when they are just kind of bombarded from the media with different kinds of propaganda for the normalization of homosexual activity and gay marriage as well. And so, you know, many of them have not really heard the other side. And plus, you know, it's also a younger generation that is weaker and weaker on the institution of marriage as a whole. And so with a looser understanding of what marriage is all about, it makes it easier for them to adopt gay marriage as well. The result is that as time goes on, if current trends continue, gay marriage is virtually inevitable. In some ways, it's a kind of irony then that perhaps the Massachusetts High Court and the mayor in San Francisco and other places that are now engaging in civil disobedience have actually forced the issue right now. And in fact, I think there are many gay activists that are unhappy that the mayor of San Francisco began handing out those marriage licenses to gay couples. And that's being done elsewhere as well. They're unhappy because they know that this may be a bit premature because public opinion has reacted rather strongly against it. You see an example of this last year when the Supreme Court decided its case in Texas versus Lawrence, which struck down an anti-sodomy statute in Texas. And there was actually a significant bounce in public opinion polls against legitimizing gay marriage in the wake of that case. And I think the same thing is happening now as well. There are pretty strong national majorities right now against gay marriage. And what this means, I think, is that ultimately the issue is going to be fought out probably with respect to the federal marriage amendment. There's an amendment in Congress that's been proposed to say that marriage is between one man and one woman. And I think that's probably our last best hope for staving off the legalization of gay marriage in this country.
So two things. As a strategy, the proponents of gay marriage, if they want a good solid success and acceptance of this change in one of our basic institutions, probably are in favor of a gradualist approach, an incremental approach, rather than the one we've seen of the last several weeks and months. What are your thoughts on what's become then the basic reaction to those events, and that is the proposed federal amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
I mean, I think the reaction is the only sensible one under the circumstances. I mean, I think it's frankly outrageous that judges should have this kind of power, the power that they have in our current political system. But unfortunately, it's there. It's not likely to go away anytime very soon, especially because there are, you know, strong clientele groups and interest groups that have a vested interest in that judicial power. And the legal profession as a whole has a kind of vested interest in it. And so, you know, it's not likely that anytime soon judges are going to be reined in the way that I think they should be. Now, given that fact, you know, what else can you do when gay marriage is staring at you from a pretty near-term horizon? Under the circumstances, it seems to me that the only thing you can do is to amend the Constitution and make it clear that it reserves marriage for a man and a woman. The other advantage of that debate is that it will continue the debate and give those of us on the side of more traditional marriage a chance to try to articulate our message more effectively than we have done in the past. And frankly, it's not just a question of getting an amendment in and then, you know, wiping our hands of it. Because even an amendment can be repealed. I mean, prohibition was repealed. If national sentiment continues to change, if we don't educate people as to what marriage really is, then down the road, even an amendment's not going to help. So we really have to use the fight over the amendment as well as over state defensive marriage amendments as an opportunity to try to educate people on this issue, because if we don't do that, we're going to lose. And frankly, that's how I got into this area in the first place. I'm president of a group called the American Public Philosophy Institute, and in the summer of '96, we had a conference on the family, and we were, you know, looking to follow that up with other topics. And the topic that naturally presented itself was homosexuality. The reason being that the people on our side of the issue, in favor of a more traditional understanding of homosexuality, we're really not doing a very effective job articulating our case. And it seemed to me and to other people I was working with that we needed to have a conference that would bring together a wide range of really articulate proponents of a more traditional view of marriage and who would be able to deal with a lot of issues associated with homosexuality so that people would be in a position to defend what we think is the sensible position. And so we had this conference. It had enough material that we eventually produced two books. One's called Homosexuality in American Public Life, and the other is called Same Sex Matters, The Challenge of Homosexuality. And those books were intended not just to try to persuade people on the other side, although, of course, we'd like to do that, or even people in the middle. In many cases, what we want to do is to educate our own people, because many people have good instincts on this issue. They realize there's something, you know, abnormal about homosexuality, that there's something problematic about gay marriage, but are not really able to articulate the reasons for it very well. And our goal was to try to provide a kind of resource for people so that, you know, if they read these books and study the various articles on the different aspects of the issue, they'll really be in a much more effective position to make a good argument against some of the emerging changes in the law.
Now, let's be more specific then. How do you make that case, not only as to the aberrant nature of homosexuality, but to the long-term consequences of a nation deciding that gay marriage, in whatever form it takes, is something that they want to embrace?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of different, you know, features here. I mean, there are different levels of argumentation you can use. When you're dealing with homosexuality in general, I think one thing you have to do is you have to deal with the allegation that homosexuality is biologically determined, it's kind of hardwired in people, and therefore that those people are in a way, inevitably homosexual. Because, in fact, I don't think that's true. I think there's, you know, reasonable evidence that the whatever genetic contribution to homosexuality there is, it's quite limited. It's a wonderful article by Dr. Jeffrey Satinover, a former fellow in psychiatry at Yale in homosexuality in American public life, which deals pretty exhaustively with the current literature on that subject and shows very well, I think, that whatever genetic contribution there is kind of limited. So that's one level of argument. Another level of argument is just to understand the medical side of homosexuality, and especially male homosexuality. Anal intercourse is enormously unhealthy. It's not just AIDS; it's all kinds of very serious physical problems. So much so that there's some evidence that the lifespan of the average male homosexual is not years shorter than a typical heterosexual, it's decades shorter. And that should be a real wake-up call, even to people who are kind of on the fence on moral issues. I mean, you might want to point out to them, well, gosh, even in terms of just public health and preserving people's lives, you know, you ought to have a concern for the spread of this particular lifestyle. So, I mean, you can argue in certain basic ways, but then, of course, ultimately you have to push on to other questions. You have to push on to the moral questions, you know, whether or not there are certain principles of sexual morality that are essential for the well-being of society. And then ultimately that gets pushed further to the whole question of the institution of marriage, what it is that marriage is as an institution, why society depends on it, why it's so important to maintain it, and why, in fact, it's been crumbling. Because all you have to do is look at the last 40 years, and you see, first of all, that there's an enormous number of kids who are born outside of marriage. You know, illegitimacy rates are higher than they've ever been in this country. And then second, you have as well the problem of divorce, especially with no-fault divorce beginning around 1970 by the action of the states. You've had a tremendous increase in divorce, which has leveled off, but it's leveled off at very high rates. So the result is that you get a family institution in this country where many, many children are not raised by both their mother and their father. And that pretty clearly is the ideal, that, and many, many divorced people would say that themselves. You know, they're not divorced because they think it's the ideal. It's, you know, they feel like they've been compelled to by circumstances. And we've got to figure out what we need to do in this country to try to reduce the incidence of illegitimacy, to reduce the incidence of divorce. And that involves really seriously rethinking the institution of marriage and what the conditions for that institution are. And frankly, a huge part of our problem is that, you know, the homosexuality issue is not something that stands alone. It's not an independent problem. It's part of a much broader sexual revolution, which includes really a revolution in heterosexual morality. And because homosexuality is rooted in changes in heterosexual mores, it makes the battle very difficult because, you know, frankly, a lot of heterosexuals have a different or a new conception of what sex is all about that would make it very difficult to provide any plausible case against homosexual sex. And as long as heterosexuals are especially attached to the idea of a kind of sex that's divorced from marriage and divorced from children, it's going to be very difficult for them to understand why homosexual sex is problematic and why it tends to undermine marriage.
We're talking with Dr. Christopher Wolf of Marquette University about gay marriage. How do we respond to the civil rights ploy that's put forth by the gay activists? I read from the Associated Press where more than 24 black pastors were meeting in Atlanta to criticize the same-sex marriage attempts, but also to distance the civil rights struggle from the gay rights movement and defend marriage as a union between a man and a woman. A reaction came from one Reverend Paul Turner, who's a gay pastor in Atlanta, who asks, how do they figure that it's not a civil rights issue? This is just the way for those conservative leadership in the black community to say, look, this isn't a matter of civil rights because we're black and we didn't have a choice in being black. He says, they think gays do have a choice, but that's not true. How do we react to that connection that's being attempted there?
Well, partly what you point out is it's not even a question of whether it's a choice. Let's suppose that we're dealing with a person who has, you know, serious psychological problems, and not because he chose to be, let's say, schizophrenic. He is. Does the fact that somebody doesn't choose to be a schizophrenic mean that we don't consider schizophrenia a serious mental issue, a mental health issue? Well, of course we would. I mean, it's certainly possible that people don't choose homosexuality. They obviously choose homosexual acts. But I think it's actually true that the same-sex attractions themselves are not normally chosen. I think the results largely of early childhood experiences rather than choices. I mean, there are some cases of what you might call the kind of ideological homosexuality where it's chosen. I think it's especially true of certain kinds of, you know, lesbianism, which can come out of a certain kind of extreme form of feminism. But, you know, for the most part, the people who feel attracted to people of their own sex didn't choose that. But as the example of schizophrenia indicates, that doesn't mean it's all right. It doesn't mean it's not a harmful thing or a bad thing. The question is, what do you do when you have the situation? I mean, one thing you try to do is you try to understand the causes of it and try to reverse them. And there is some evidence that, in fact, people with same-sex attractions, given the proper therapy and help and moral support, can, in fact, change their sexual attractions. It's important to recognize that this is not an easy thing to do. It's not as if, you know, well, all homosexuals have to do is, you know, just make an effort, and if they make a bit of an effort, they can change their attractions. It really is a very difficult thing. It's actually something on the order of a similar kind of problem, which is the problem of alcoholism, where, you know, it's true that alcoholics can cease to be alcoholics in some sense. They can kind of change their reliance on drink. But, boy, it's a really tough process to go through, and not an easy one by any means. So that would be one thing. You could try to at least make it possible for those who are willing to make the effort to try to make that transformation or that change. Then you try to encourage the other people that what's really in their best interest is not to give in to these tendencies. I guess in this respect, you know, a lot of Americans would hesitate about that because they really feel reluctant, as they would phrase it, to, you know, condemn somebody to a celibate life. But, I mean, I think that's what we should tell heterosexuals as well. You know, we should tell heterosexuals, listen, if you haven't really found a person to marry, well, then you shouldn't engage in sex, because sex is something that should occur in the context of marriage, and it should be, you know, open to children. That's what it's essentially oriented toward. And if you're doing it outside of marriage, you're really, you know, abusing this particular capacity human beings have, and it's not too surprising if down the road, you know, there's a kind of trivialization of sex. If it's reduced to a means of achieving intimacy and pleasure, but divorced really from the more fundamental purposes that it has as the basis for the family. And so we have to try to, you know, alert people, help them to understand this, and it's tough because, as I say, the real problem is in our whole transformed understanding of sex, not just for homosexuals, but for heterosexuals as well.
Now, where does that lead, Dr. Wolf? You mentioned before a sexual autonomy principle that's been guiding the courts. Of course, it's alive and well in the culture as well. You've mentioned that already as well. But where does it lead beyond gay marriage? Is there any place here? Of course, it's been made ad nauseum, but is there any place here for at least the beginnings of a slippery slope argument? If we continue the sexual revolution apace without a break put upon it, where will it lead next?
Well, we're well down the slippery slope. I mean, just the fact that we're considering gay marriage is an indication that we're very far down the slope. But yeah, there is even more room on the slope left still. Last year, the American Law Institute came out, very prestigious institute that makes recommendations for reforming law, and they came out with proposals for marriage law that really would make it more and more something that's, you know, in a way almost kind of defined by the people getting married, that really would give a lot of freedom to people to define marriage as they want to. Now, in some areas, you actually are seeing the beginnings of people who are advocating that what they call polyamory, a new word for polygamy, should be legally protected because it involves the same kind of sexual autonomy issue. Another example down the road might be, you know, what about marriages for certain terms or lengths of time? You know, somebody might get married with a contract that provides for marriage for 10 years with an option to renew if the people involved choose to renew. I'm not saying that these are likely to happen even, but the question is, once we embrace the essential principle of gay marriage that in a way allows us to kind of shape marriage the way we want to for our own desires and purposes, is there any reasonable ground we would have to resist those kinds of changes or reforms? And I think the answer is no, that, you know, once you accept the principle that marriage is a merely human institution that can be kind of adapted by human beings to their own purposes, at that point it's very difficult to really maintain a very strong and stable family. I mean, it's partly, you know, of course, in religious terms, I guess we'd see it in terms of original sin in particular, that there are all kinds of tendencies in human beings that would lead us in ways that make it tough to sustain stable married relationships.
With only 30 seconds here, Dr. Wolf, how effective of a break will the proposed federal amendment on marriage be, if it's successful, on the principle of sexual autonomy in law and in society?
Well, it's hard to know, but at least it will provide us with an anchor in the Constitution to argue against the sexual autonomy principle. You know, part of our problem is that originally, with the original Constitution, most of those kinds of issues were left to the states, so there was no need to include a principle in the Constitution that would defend some kind of stable marriage institution. It was dealt with at the state level, and all the states had solid, stable systems. The problem is that once that began to break down, there was no anchor in the Constitution, no part of it that you could appeal to stop it. And one of the benefits of the Federal Marriage Amendment is that it would root in the Constitution itself a principle that would help us to argue not only with respect to gay marriage, but other things as well.
Dr. Christopher Wolf, thank you very much for your good work for compiling both of these books, and thanks for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Okay, Jeff, if I could just mention that the book is available to your listeners for a 50% discount if they want to call Spence Publishing Company.
All right, I've got the phone number and the website address as well. Dr. Christopher Wolf of Marquette University, editor of the book Homosexuality in American Public Life, at www.spencepublishing.com or 1-888-SPENPUB. That's SPENPUB. www.spencepublishing.com. It's a 50% discount. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Perhaps St. Peter is best known for his greatest sin, denying Jesus Christ three times. But the story of St. Peter is really the story of God's grace in Jesus Christ. It's really the story of every Christian. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is called Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's the story of God's grace shown to St. Peter in Jesus Christ our Savior. This children's book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. It's our book of the month for March. Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Stuart Shepherd. The proposed federal marriage amendment got its first hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. At stake, the very definition of what marriage is. Keith Peters was there.
The hearing was crammed with supporters and opponents of the federal marriage amendment. Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank was one of the people supporting homosexual rights.
How does the fact that I or someone else wants to express love for another human being in the same way as the overwhelming majority of my heterosexual friends and relatives, how does that hurt you?
But Senator John Cornyn says how we arrange the building blocks of society affects all of us.
A casual attitude toward divorce and cohabitation has had serious consequences for the institution of marriage for the last 20 years. Redefining marriage in a way that reduces it to a financial and legal arrangement of adult relationships will only accelerate the deterioration of family life.
He says supporters of traditional marriage face an unhappy task.
Either we give up the traditional institution of marriage to activists in the streets and on the bench, or we enshrine the traditional institution of marriage with the constitutional protection that our children need and deserve.
Cornyn says the traditional institution of marriage is too important. It's worth defending, and worth defending with a constitutional amendment. So the important process of amending the U.S. Constitution begins. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
In the hearing, one of the sponsors of the amendment, Senator Wayne Allard, said marriage has been the foundation of every civilization in human history. He says the goal of the federal marriage amendment is to define and preserve the historic and cultural definition of marriage. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
Have you ever considered establishing an estate plan that continues your Christian giving after your death? Well, the ministries that you support financially during your lifetime, including KFUO Radio, may continue to do their work even after you have gone to heaven. By including a gift to these ministries in your estate plan, you display the Holy Spirit's guidance in your life. You could include a gift in your will, trust, beneficiary designation, or other methods. For more information, call Janelle at 1-888-930-4438.
Issues, Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Pastor Eric Rotman. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The book is Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We have talked about intelligent design many times here on Issues Etc. And it's one that always comes up whenever we revisit the issue of the creation-evolution debate because, well, it doesn't exactly stand in either camp, really, because it is a scientific theory rather than a set of theological propositions. It does not argue for a creator per se, but certainly a designer. I was talking earlier with one of our guests on the program. He said, look, you find a watch in the woods. You are within the bounds of logic to posit a watchmaker. You look around the world and you see a level of design, design on such a scale, small and large. You're within the bounds of logic. And good theory to posit a designer. That's the essence of intelligent design. But of course, it is not without its critics, and it's not without questions that need to be posed to it. So that's what we'll do here in these 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Dr. William Dembski is our guest. He's associate researcher in the Conceptual Foundations of Science at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute's Center for the Renewal of Science. And he's author of several books, including his latest, The Design Revolution, Answering the Toughest Questions About Intelligent Design. Dr. Dembski, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you.
Give us a basic outline of ID as a scientific theory.
Right. Intelligent design, it's the science of signs of intelligence. So we do this in many special sciences already. Archaeologists, for instance, want to know, is that a burial mound or is it just a randomly formed mound? Is that an arrowhead, this chunk of rock I'm looking at, or is it just a rock that's the result of weathering and erosion and things like that? And so we draw these distinctions. Is it designed? Is it the result of purpose, intention, intelligence, or is it the result of accident, chance, randomness? And we do this in a lot of different disciplines. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. You're looking for signs of intelligence from radio signals from outer space. In that case, you're not even looking for human intelligence. It's some alien intelligence. And so we draw these distinctions in many areas, and intelligent design broadly is the science for studying and identifying these signs of intelligence. Where it gets controversial is when you start asking, well, are there signs of intelligence in biological systems? And the reason it gets controversial there is that the biological community is committed to the idea that all of intelligence that we see in the world is really an evolved intelligence. It's something that you get by a blind, purposeless evolutionary process. So there's no intelligence built in the front. But if you find signs of intelligence in biological systems, then there had to have been a prior intelligence there. And so that's what makes it controversial, because it's really challenging this whole materialistic and naturalistic worldview, which says that it's all at base just brute matter in motion, and intelligence and all the things we value are really just evolutionary byproducts.
But intelligent design as a scientific theory does not purport to identify the intelligence that is the source of the design that we witness here in nature.
That's right, and it's not because we're being coy or deceitful. I mean, the thing is, you can only go so far from the data of nature. It's a scientific program. What you're doing is looking at finite arrangements of matter, seeing patterns there which would point you to an intelligence. That's very different from a doctrine of creation, which is always about the source of being of the world. Where did things come from in the first place? So one way to illustrate this is there's a joke that was making it around on the internet some years back. Scientists come to God and say, "We can do everything you can do." And God says, "Oh, is that so? Well, show me." And they say, "Yeah, well, we can build humans from scratch." And says, "Okay, well, how are you going to do that?" "Well, we take some dust and they're about to do some genetic engineering." And God says, "Well, wait a second, get your own dust." You know, and so the point is, you know, where does the stuff come from in the first place? The doctrine of creation, a personal transcendent creator God, is one who gives being to the world. What intelligent design says is, okay, if we take an already existing world, are there features of it that could point us to intelligence? And the nature of that intelligence, it can't really speculate on. Now, as a Christian, as a theist, you'll come back and say, well, wait a second, that intelligence is then the God that I worship. But that's a theological or metaphysical move that you make subsequently. It's not something where the science, strictly speaking, takes you.
What role does information play in intelligent design?
Well, what you have in intelligent design is you have these markers of intelligence. I mean, it's, as I said, it's looking for signs of intelligence. And the sign of intelligence that you're looking for is information. It's a specific type of information. It's not just brute complexity. I mean, you can get information just by flipping a coin. You flip a coin 1,000 times, you're going to get a random sequence. There's a lot of information there in what's called the Shannon or mathematical information theoretic sense. What you really want is you want not just brute complexity, that type of information, but you want what's called specified complexity. There's also got to be a pattern. There's got to be a specification there. And so if you remember the movie Contact, for instance, this was a movie based on a novel by Carl Sagan. These radio astronomers were looking for signs of intelligence from outer space. And there's a key instance where contact is established, where they know that they're in the presence of an alien intelligence. It's when they get a long sequence of prime numbers. Prime numbers are numbers divisible only by themselves in one, and so it's 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, and so on, all the way up to 101. It takes a lot of bits to represent that, over 1,000 bits. And when they get this sequence, this one radio astronomer turns to the other and says, "This isn't noise, this has structure." Well, what is it about that sequence? It's long, it's complex, it has to be long, because if you just got two beats, end of story, you know, if you're monitoring millions of radio channels from outer space, you're going to see two beats and a pause. You know, but if you have this long sequence, you know, then you've got to take notice. It's going to be hard to reproduce that thing by chance. Additionally, there's an independent, objectively given pattern there, and that's the specification. So what you're looking for is not just information, but complex specified information. And when you have that, then you've got a reliable indicator of intelligence.
So, in other words, the ability to distinguish between what could be random, a random noise beat in any kind of system, masquerading as intelligence, and the what can only be the product of intelligence is really a function of how long is the message, how complex is the message, how coherent is the message, things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got to nail it down precisely. I mean, this has been the challenge. I mean, because the people on the other side, the materialists, will want to say, well, we really can't tell. You know, it's whether something is in biology, let's say, is designed. It's whether it matches these criteria. And so you have to lay out, well, what are the criteria, in fact? Also, it's important to keep in mind that we are the evidence here is always circumstantial. It's not that we are looking. The video camera is running, and that we see, you know, the intelligence that's doing the creating. You know, it's not like, you know, we have firsthand knowledge. In biology, we are here after the fact. Biological systems have been around, and then we have to look at those systems, do the analysis, see if they have those features that really cannot be explained by anything other than intelligence. And so, complexity is needed. I mean, the thing is, intelligences can do things that are simple and unspecified, but if they do that, and if the video camera is not running, we won't know it. You know, so if we got two beats and a pause from outer space, it could be that an alien was transmitting the first prime number, the number two. But, you know, if you're monitoring millions of radio channels, you're going to see two beats and a pause repeatedly. So it's not going to nail it down. That's why in the movie it had to be 2, 3, all the way up to 101. It was a long sequence.
Now, a recent guest on the program pointed out what I consider to be kind of a delicious irony, and that is, using exactly the same reference from the movie Contact, when those numbers came in from outer space and they had this, what was unmistakably the product of intelligence on the other end, they said, this must be the product of a design by an intelligence. However, in biological systems, you look at the genetic code, there is a very sophisticated message there. Granted, a lot of noise in there as well. Very complex, and yet the same people will often say, no, that cannot be the product of intelligence or design with an intelligence behind it.
Question, why is that?
Why will they recognize it in one and not recognize it in another?
Well, I think let me put on their hats. I mean, I think what they would want to say is that with the prime numbers, you're dealing with something that has already a pre-established meaning for humans. On the other hand, when you're looking at the genetic code, what you've got there is you've got sequences of DNA that are coding for proteins. It's not the message is not that clear. I mean, what you have is you're coding for functional, biologically significant functional objects. But I think they would want to press the disanalogy there and say, well, it's not really a message in the full sense as we're getting, let's say, in this Contact movie example. So I think that's one of the things that they would really want to stress. And the other thing, though, is that they think that basically all instances of biological complexity can be decomposed, can be simplified into bite-sized chunks of smaller levels of complexity by means of the Darwinian mechanism. So Darwin's mechanism of natural selection and random variation is supposed to be able to ratchet up to these levels of complexity by some gradual Darwinian route. Now, that's the big claim of Darwinism, and that's the one that we are in the intelligent design movement are challenging. You know, but I think that they offer some rationalizations. I mean, they're not just going to say, yeah, we've got a double standard, but, you know, we're just going to live with it because we don't like design or something like that. I mean, they'll offer some rationalizations.
We're talking about intelligent design with Dr. William Dembski of Baylor University. He's author of several books, including his latest, The Design Revolution, Answering the Toughest Questions About Intelligent Design. Every time we talk about intelligent design on the program, Dr. Dembski, the name Michael Behe comes up and the term irreducible complexity. Can you explain this to us?
Sure. Behe is a biochemist, and what he found was that at the subcellular level, there are systems of tremendous complexity. These are molecular machines which do a lot of nifty things. And so one that's really gotten the most play is called the bacterial flagellum. It's a little motor-driven propeller that's on the backs of certain bacteria. It spins in both directions. It can spin up to 100,000 RPM. Most of them spin around 20,000 RPM. You look at this under an electron micrograph, and it's a machine. I mean, you've got a propeller. It's basically, the propeller is a long filament, and you've got a hook that connects this thing to a drive shaft. You've got various discs that mount the apparatus. You've got stators, O-rings, and you've got an acid-powered drive. So, you know, you look at this and you say, "Hey, this is a machine." Now, what's important about this, so it's complex, but what makes it irreducibly complex? What makes it irreducibly complex is that this is a functionally integrated system. All the pieces have to be there for this thing to work. And what's more, it's non-simplifiable. You can't really get that function, this motility structure, this function of moving the bacterium through its watery environment without all those components there. So then the question is, you know, how are you going to get something like this by means of an evolutionary process? Because an evolutionary process is supposed to build something up gradually, but you don't have this function of moving the bacterium through its watery environment until all the pieces are there. You know, so how do you get this? I mean, it seems like you have to get it all in one fell swoop. And so the only response on the part of the Darwinian community has been to say, well, you're not going to get this bacterial flagellum, in one fell swoop, but you might be able to get other things that are components of it that serve other functions. And so you might be able to get there by an indirect route. It's a lot of hand-waving. Biologists have no detailed, testable, step-by-step scenarios how this might have happened. They're just throwing out a wild speculation. And in fact, there are now biologists who are not intelligent design theorists who are admitting that these Darwinian explanations just constitute wishful speculations, that they really don't have anything, that they don't have a clue, in effect. So Behe has really put his finger on a problem that's of major proportions. I mean, here you've got a theory, evolutionary theory, which is supposed to, without which nothing in biology is supposed to make sense, and yet it's failing not just to explain the bacterial flagellum, but it's a pervasive failure of explaining any type of systems like this. So Behe's work is very significant.
I've thought about it in these terms. They're very simple, but I wonder whether or not intelligent design's threat to Darwinian evolution really lies in the fact that it is, as a system of thought, as a theory, intuitive. Whereas, as years go by, Darwin's and the subsequent theories coming from his ideas are ever more so counterintuitive.
Well, I think there's something to that. You know, you don't start out being a Darwinist. In fact, I had a conversation with a fellow named Michael Shermer, who's a well-known skeptic, and this was a few years back. He was just in the process of sending off to the publisher a book called How We Believe, and he was examining how is it that people hold belief in God. And he surveyed 10,000 people, asking them about their beliefs in God, and there were two questions in particular that he focused on. There were others, but there are two. He asked people, you know, why do you think other people believe in God, and why do you believe in God? When the question was posed, why do you think other people believe in God, at the top of the list were things like religious experience, God as a comfort or crutch, as he put it, you know. But when the question was posed, well, why do you believe in God? The top answer was the order and complexity of the world. And so I think that's where people's intuitions start. And then you have to be educated out of those intuitions. You know, Richard Dawkins, a well-known atheistic Darwinist, will write a book called The Blind Watchmaker. Page one, he'll write, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So that's how he defines it. You know, that's how he defines biology. And then he needs another 300 pages to explain why it's only an appearance, why if you really do the analysis, you know, then you'll see that your intuitions are wrong. Now, it happens that our intuitions can be wrong. I mean, you know, our intuitions about space is that it's Euclidean three-dimensional, and in fact, you know, it appears that Einstein got it right and that space in gravitational field does get warped. Okay, so intuition need not be a reliable guide always, you know, but it's at least a starting point. And what intelligent design is doing is saying, look, it is arguing cogently that our intuitions about design are in fact accurate, and that what Darwinism has been offering are really rationalizations and not cogent arguments for why we should reject design.
One of the biggest criticisms leveled against intelligent design, Dr. Dembski, and you mentioned it briefly at the beginning of our conversation, is that intelligent design is simply a coy or clever way of putting forth creationism or scientific creationism or some form of creationism in a disguised form. How do you respond?
Well, I think this will be disproven increasingly as more and more people come on board who cannot be classified as theists. I was giving some lectures at Oxford University in England in October, and my sponsors were the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. And so I spoke there and spoke in other places, they were very congenial and actually entirely on board with what I was saying. And I think what we're going to find increasingly is that people with religious longings, people with spiritual aspirations, who think that there is some sort of purposiveness or intelligence behind the world, who don't think it's just all brute matter in motion, are going to find intelligent design congenial. And they're also, I think, a lot of people with spiritual longings are getting tired of being constantly bullied by a materialistic establishment that casts itself as in the mantle of science. They've become the high priests of our society. They're the ones who can tell us what ultimate reality is constituted of, and tell us also that our religious aspirations have no ultimate significance. You know, I think people are tired of that. So it's not just a Christian thing. I think increasingly we're going to find that many people are going to be coming on board. Now, I think as a Christian, and I am a Christian, I think this is a good thing, but I think it also presents a challenge to the church. Intelligent design is a very ambitious program scientifically. It's challenging Darwinian evolution, challenging the idea that chance and necessity are the only legitimate modes of scientific explanation. It's introducing intelligent causation at a fundamental level in science. But philosophically and theologically, it's very modest. It just gets you to a generic sort of designer. And so I think it's going to be incumbent on the church to say, look, what are we going to do with intelligence? We have to interpret it theologically and make good sense out of it so it doesn't get co-opted by other religious groups, you know, and then used for theological mileage there. So I think it's going to be a challenge for the church to use intelligent design wisely. The thing is, what intelligent design will do for the Christian is, I mean, it provides a tool for dislodging this materialist ideology, you know. But materialism isn't the only heresy out there, so you know, so we get rid of that, and I think it'll be a good thing regardless to have gotten rid of materialism. But there will be other challenges then following.
Would you say that we're really left with just these two options? Either the system proposed by the Darwinian evolutionist, or in terms of a scientific theory, an intelligent designer?
Yeah, I think those become the two main options. I mean, because you can try to find some sort of unstable equilibrium where, yes, there's teleology, there's some sort of purposiveness there, but it's not scientifically detectable. And that's a line, for instance, which somebody like Kenneth Miller at Brown University will take. So he'll say he's an Orthodox Darwinian and an Orthodox Catholic. But it's an unstable position, because what he's basically saying then is that materialist scientists have gotten the science right, but I'm still going to go with the Christian faith, and it's a tough marriage to keep together, you know. And intelligent design, it's saying that there are marks of intelligence in the world that cannot be explained away in terms of material processes, and we can establish this reliably.
With only 1 minute before we have to go, Dr. Dembski, what can intelligent design theory, as a scientific theory, what can it give us? What can it prove, if you will? What can it never deliver or prove?
Well, I think it can establish that there is an intelligence of marvelous capacities that's behind the biological world and also at the astrophysical level. I mean, there's friends of mine, Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez, who've just written The Privileged Planets, which is making design arguments at the level of cosmology. But these sorts of design arguments, as I said just a moment ago, they're not going to get you to the Christian God. They'll get you to a designer, an intelligence. That's friendly to Christian theism in a way that Darwinian evolution was never friendly. I mean, Darwinian evolution really undercut the faith because it was saying that there's really no design there. And as Christians, we know that God by wisdom created the world. So it's, so I think it's what intelligent design is doing is it's clearing away a lot of the rubble and mess that scientific materialism and Darwinism have bequeathed to us.
And very briefly, has it moved beyond the biological sciences?
In terms of intelligent design and its impact, yes. I mean, it's certainly it's working in biology, cosmology, but then also into the broader culture, into the educational establishment. A lot of debate about it.
Dr. William Dembski, thank you very much for your good work, and thank you for being our guest. Dr. William Dembski is associate research in the Conceptual Foundations of Science at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He is senior fellow for the Discovery Institute's Center for the Renewal of Science, and he is author of several books, including his latest titled The Design Revolution, Answering the Toughest Questions About Intelligent Design. By the way, folks, on Friday, we're going to have a two-hour conversation with Dr. Ron Rhodes on the creation-evolution debate, and he does mention several times the utility of intelligent design as a theory. When it was first came to my attention about 3 years ago, I was wont to point out to fellow six-day creationists that this is a theory that acknowledges its limits, so let's not push it farther or attempt to push it farther than it wants to go. As time has gone by, I've been increasingly impressed with its utility, with its ability to take apart the rather shaky structure of Darwinian evolution. Wherever it tries to set itself up, intelligent design is able to intelligently, pardon the pun, but also with all scientific integrity, counter, or at the very least offer an alternative to, an illogical alternative to, those things proposed by evolution. It's not one that's ever going to get you back to the engineer. It's not an attempt to reverse engineer the universe back to the engineer himself, but it is an attempt to say, look, if we can reverse engineer this, there probably is an engineer. When we come back, we're going to talk about Oneness Pentecostal.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.